This is Robin Umber. It's April 27th, 2009, and I'll be interviewing Patty C. at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Okay, Patty, what is the date and place of your birth?
July 14th, 1968, and I was born in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
What is your race?
Caucasian.
What is your ancestry or ethnicity?
German and a little bit of Native American.
How many male and or female siblings do you have?
I have 2 brothers and 5 sisters.
What is your birth order in the family?
I'm the youngest of 8.
How many children do you have?
I have 1 son who's 17.
Okay. Can you tell me about the community and neighborhood where you grew up?
Sure. I grew up in Chippewa Falls. It was a typical small town, really safe, peaceful. The neighborhood was an older neighborhood for Chippewa Falls. My parents had one of the first houses on the block, and we had the same neighbors for probably about 40 years. So the neighborhood was really established by the time I came around, lots of kids to play with, always games in the street. It was really a really good place to grow up.
Okay, can you tell me or describe how your family was or was not connected to the community and neighborhood?
Sure. My parents were always involved in everything. They were ideal citizens. They were involved in the school. They were involved in church. Both of them did PTA. Both of them did Boy Scouts with my brothers. They were the kind of people who reached out to everyone, and as a kid, I was so embarrassed by them because wherever they went, they would talk to people as if they were old friends. And it's interesting because as I was thinking about my neighborhood and the way that my parents were when I was a kid and how I was so embarrassed by them, I realized that I do the same thing, and my son is equally embarrassed by me, that wherever I go, I just reach out to people and I talk to anybody, and I really have a sense of community, I'm sure, because of where I grew up and also, of course, because of my parents. And the Women's Studies program, at its core, I think, is just about reaching out and nurturing people and empowering people, and I'm sure that's where that came from, even though for about the first 25 years of my life, I was embarrassed by it.
Okay. Who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect you and your family?
I don't know that I had any idea who had power and privilege in my community, but I do know that within my family, my mother really had all of the power. My parents had a traditional Catholic relationship. My dad went to work. My mom stayed home, raised children. They had as many children as they could have. And though on the surface it appeared that my dad really was the one who had the power because he had the money and he had the job and he drove, my mother never got her license. Within the family sphere, there was never any doubt that my mom ruled the house. And so as far as privilege, looking back, I guess I came from a privileged family given the amount of money my father made and our place in the community, but I don't know that I ever really felt privileged in any way.
Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
I look back and think, how could I not? Because I was a tomboy, I was really athletic, I was into sports year-round, and I was also surrounded by powerful women. I had 5 older sisters who just were all strong women. My mother was, though she really was traditional and she was a housewife and a stay-at-home mom, she really was a powerful woman. And I remember watching the Mary Tyler Moore Show and it just really attracted to strong women. All of my teachers were women and the nuns I had, even though they were nuns, and on the surface perhaps they didn't have a whole lot of power, they really were powerful within their specific roles. So I think about that. I think about Title IX, of course, had to affect my upbringing, the birth of MTV, and the 80s were such a strange time. We got to see Madonna wearing barely any clothes with a rosary around her neck. And I was going to Catholic school, so that was such an outrage. But then it was also Nancy Reagan, just say no. And so lots of mixed messages. And but I think, though I never would have used the word feminist as a young adult or a teenager or a child, I think how could I not become a feminist given everything going on? And I think about the posters that were in my bedroom as a kid. I had a poster of Magic Johnson, and I had a poster of Ann Myers, who was a UCLA basketball star who tried out for the LA Lakers and the first woman to do that. And then I also had a poster of Mother Teresa. So with those role models, how could I not turn into a feminist, I guess?
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to share about your childhood experiences?
I don't think so.
I kind of thought that you said so much. I thought sort of went into that. Okay. Could you describe your educational path after high school?
Sure. I was the youngest of eight, and many of my siblings went on to college. All went either to UW-Eau Claire or to UW-Stout. And my parents' mantra was that we have these two universities close to home. Why would you go anywhere else? So I didn't apply anywhere else except for UW-Eau Claire. I lived at home. I commuted. And I was a social work major for a semester. I was an education major for a semester. And I ended up with a degree in English with a minor in creative writing. I think I had always known that I wanted to be a writer, but I thought that I would have to have the kind of degree where I could have a day job too.
Okay. And can you describe your occupational path then after college?
Sure. When I was a senior in college, I ended up getting pregnant, and good Catholic girl that I was, I got married. And so I graduated when I was about 4 months pregnant, and I had a degree in English and creative writing, and so I waitressed for a long time. I stayed at home with my son, and eventually, when he was about 18 months old, I started to take graduate courses at UW-Eau Claire. I thought I would just see how it went. And eventually, I became a graduate assistant and just fell in love with higher education and knew that this was the place that I wanted to be. I also had just great mentors in graduate school. Carol Fairbanks mentored me, and she was the first professor I ever had who said, "Call me Carol." And like a lot of great teachers I've had, she saw me not as I was, this lowly graduate student, but as what I might become, a future colleague. And that really changed my life. So then when I graduated with a master's degree, also in English, I applied here at UW-Eau Claire for a position in the Academic Skills Center. It was just supposed to be a semester-long position, 50%. Supervising tutoring programs for multicultural students and students with disabilities. And it was ideal because my son was 3 years old. I still wanted to be home with him as much as I could, so I worked 20 hours a week. And that position, though it was only supposed to be a semester-long position, grew into a full-time position around the time my son started kindergarten. And then from there grew into other things, teaching occasionally for the English department and teaching in the Women's Studies program.
Can you describe the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist?
Well, I think I always had feminist tendencies, but I wouldn't have identified them as feminism. And part of it, I think, is the time that I came of age. I turned 18 in 1986. And in high school, in college, I remember thinking, I'm not a feminist, but... And then I would have all of these qualifiers. And when I was about a sophomore in college, I had my first women's literature class. And it was the first time that I was exposed to feminist literature. But I don't think I recognized it as such. I just thought it was women's literature. And my professor was Carol Fairbanks, who of course was a feminist and who was active in the Women's Studies program. But I don't ever remember her using that word. And part of it may have been just a sign of the time, so it had to have been 1988 or so then. And so I was exposed to feminist literature. I really connected with it. And then in graduate school, I started to identify with the word feminist. I was doing my master's thesis on Tilly Olson and mother and daughter literature, and so I was reading a lot of feminist texts. But they were from the 1960s and 70s, and I thought, these women's experiences have nothing to do with my experiences. So at that point, I started to think, I am a feminist, but, and I still have the same kind of qualifiers, until I started to read some of the third wave feminist texts, and it was sort of like coming home for me, reading the work of Rebecca Walker and Amy Richards and Jennifer Baumgardner, and just realizing that, oh, this is the kind of feminist I am. And that was really a life-changing moment for me, I think, just realizing that's me, that's my experience.
What resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you became a feminist?
Well, I don't know that I ever talked. I certainly didn't talk with my family about it. And again, you know, all of my sisters, I'm sure, are feminists, but they would never use that word. And coming from a working class family, I think, you know, women worked just as hard as the men did and expected equality, at least in my family and in my neighborhood, but nobody would use that word feminist. And so I think I probably didn't face any resistance because I was just a wimp and didn't ever talk about feminism with the people who mattered most to me. But I do remember I was married and I had a hyphenated name. I was Patty C. Thornton. And when I graduated with my master's degree and started to look for a job, I did not want to have to look for a job with a hyphenated name. Because of my last name, C, it always appeared as the letter C, period, Thornton, and then people would just call me Patty Thornton, and that just wasn't who I was. And I remember somebody saying to me, oh, you're not going to have your husband's name. What are you, a feminist? And it was said in such a way that was really quite hurtful. And I thought, yeah, damn right I am. Exactly. That's what I am.
Can you tell me which of your contributions have made the greatest difference to shaping feminist theories and practices and your own understanding of yourself as a feminist?
I think two things. Certainly as a woman who writes, I think I speak for women who don't have the opportunity to write about their experiences. And as a younger person, I was a mom at 22, 23, and though I had been around children all of my life, I have many nieces and nephews and grew up in a large family, I just didn't know how to make sense of being a mother myself and dealing with this little child who needed me for everything. So the one way I made sense of it was by writing about it. And I think that I'm not speaking for all women or all mothers, but I am speaking my own experience. And in speaking my own experience, I think a lot of people can identify. And also going through separation and divorce and writing about those experiences. Now I'm dealing with my mom who's dying of Alzheimer's and taking notes and writing about that experience. I think I'm really in a position of power in that I can describe my own experiences and in turn, I think, help others. Also, teaching in the Women's Studies program certainly has influenced me as a feminist. I teach a class on third wave feminism and I teach a class on feminist theories and masculinity studies. And just that interaction with students who are so fresh and honest and my role in the classroom as mentor and guide and trying to empower others and again sharing my experiences as a feminist and being honest about how I've struggled or how I've been challenged, I think has really informed my own understanding of myself.
What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
So 25 years ago, 1984, I was a sophomore in high school. And so I tried to think of, in my life, what has changed. And I think maybe most important, the expectations for girls and boys and for women and men have really changed. I know I grew up thinking I could be anything, but still fell into nurse, social worker, teacher. And I don't think girls today do that. And also the roles for boys and men. My 17-year-old son wants to become a nurse, and he took a little bit of grief for that because, you know, it's not a particularly masculine occupation, but it would be a wonderful fit for this young man who's really good in math and science. And I think would excel in the medical field. And when I was a high school senior, if somebody, if a male classmate said he wanted to be a nurse, he would just be laughed out of class. But that hasn't happened with my son Alex, and I think that is really important. I think the opportunity and choices for women and men have changed tremendously in the past 25 years. And I also think that the gender box has expanded for women and for men. What if you think about when I was a high school sophomore, what did it mean to be a woman, or what did it mean to be a man? That's changed tremendously. And in one of the third wave icons, Amy Richards says that feminism is like fluoride now, it's just in the water. I think that's a huge change in 25 years, that young people don't even necessarily think about whether or not men and women are equal, or do they have the same opportunities. I think that's just the expectation, which is great.
What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century?
I think one of the main things right now is that we don't have a unified front with central issues. One of the problems, I think, of the third wave of feminism, and perhaps even the upcoming fourth wave, is that there aren't any central issues. And so that surely could be a problem, because if you don't have central issues, then how are you going to unite all people working towards gender justice?
How long and in what ways have you been engaged with the UW-Eau Claire's women's program?
I have been involved in the program since, I think, around 2001 or 2002. I always tell this story in my women's studies classes because I think it's a great story about UW-Eau Claire. I was walking across campus and I ran into Kate Lang, who was involved in the women's studies program. And she was on her way to a women's studies program meeting, and she said, oh, you should come, or you should teach a class. And it had never crossed my mind before. I had never taken a women's studies class. I knew that the program existed, but I was never associated with it. The closest I had come was serving on the selection committee for Women's History Month Awards, but I don't know that I knew the direct connection between him and Women's History Month planning and the Women's Studies program. So she said, come to a meeting or teach a class. And at that time, the interim director was Jenny Shattuck. And so I contacted her and I said, I have a few ideas for classes. And so I created a special topics class on third wave feminism and taught it the first time just as one or two credits. And I just fell in love with teaching that class. And eventually that became one of the permanent classes in the program. I also created a class on women in film, which was really fun to plan and teach. And then most recently, I created a class on masculinity studies and feminist theories. I've been an advisor to the College Feminists for about the last 5 or 6 years or so, and I've served on the steering committee for about the past 6 years.
I was just looking to answer some other questions as you were
sure.
doing that. So. I think it's a rerun, too. You can just say that one.
Sure. Should we jump right to 18?
18, that's good. Yeah. Okay. How has the program changed during the time you've been involved with it?
Well, I think that our new director, Susan Terrell, certainly influenced the program and brought about many wonderful changes. The creation of the Women's Studies major is a huge change. I think that Susan, just because of her wonderful personality, has reached out to a lot more people on campus and recruited faculty and staff from so many different areas. And now our new interim director, Catherine Rhodes, also just has done a wonderful job of getting people involved and keeping them involved. And both Susan and Catherine really value diversity, and not just ethnic diversity, but they value different perspectives, and they really want to hear from a number of different people on campus, and they want the Women's Studies program to be open to including everyone and to empowering and nurturing faculty and staff.
Okay, I think that's related to the next question I'll ask too. What are the major contributions of UW-Eau Claire's Women's Studies to the campus community and beyond?
Well, I think that so many contributions, but one of the ones that I think about that's maybe secondary, but so important is that the program gives progressive faculty, staff, and students a home. It's a place where like-minded people who believe in gender justice can gather. And, you know, it's open to everyone. So faculty and staff who may never teach in the program still can be involved. They can come to our program committee meetings. They can come to our social events and feel connected. And really, for those new faculty who have their department as home, it's great. But then they also have women's studies as home that I think really complements their experiences.
You talked about the different things you've done with the Women's Studies program before. Did you want to say anything else about your major contributions to the success of the program?
Sure. I think two contributions that have been important. Creating Women's Studies 210, Culture of Third Wave Feminism, has helped the program. I think a lot of our students identify with third wave feminism, so having a class essentially on their experience, their generation, is important. And also, I think it's been important to the program to have a class that looks at masculinities studies and feminist theories, because of course we're looking at a gender justice movement, and for any change to continue to take place, we have to include men and women together working towards change. And I think that's a good class that hopefully we'll do that.
Okay. And what would you like your legacy in Women's Studies program to be?
Well, I would like to continue to create progressive courses, keep up with the times. I often do courses of the mind. It's fun for me to plan courses and to do the research and to think about what would I teach and how would I teach it. And so I hope to do more of that. I don't know what those courses will be, but I'm only 40, so I'll be around a few more years, and I hope that I'll continue to come up with progressive course ideas.
As you think about the future, what role do you think Women's Studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus community and beyond?
Well, I hope that the Women's Studies program continues to play the role it does now, which is a gathering place for women and men who are progressive, who are concerned about gender justice, social justice issues. And it's also, I think, it does the same kind of thing for the greater community in the Chippewa Valley. And often, if people have issues, they will come to the Women's Studies program, or they'll contact someone who they think can be a sounding board. I just think that the Women's Studies program really, really does an excellent job of getting out there and letting folks know in the campus community and beyond that this is what we stand for.
Thank you, Patty. What story is most important for you to tell as part of this oral history project?
Well, one of the things that I want to share is a life-changing experience I had about 5 years ago, when I made the decision to become a living kidney donor. And I think without my involvement in the Women's Studies program and in feminism in general, I would not have seen organ donation as a social justice issue. And I don't know that I would have been able to do this tremendous leap of faith to give away an organ to a stranger without having that decision based in feminist ethics. And so it was a life-changing experience, something I didn't necessarily expect would be life-changing going into it, but was. And so my kidney went to a 50-year-old man who decided not to meet me. So I always joke that he's out there somewhere. He could be in Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, or South Dakota. All I know is that he's healthy and that my kidney is doing well for him. And I joke that there's this guy out there who's wondering why he's now craving light beer and has feminist tendencies. But so I hope that a little bit of me is living on in him. And after I made my donation, and I didn't tell my family until afterward because I was afraid of the way that they might react or that they would try to talk me out of it. I told my son and I told a few close friends, but I didn't tell my parents or siblings. And so a colleague said to me, we'll hope that this guy is a little bit more Mother Teresa and a little less George Bush if he gets Patty C's kidney. And I thought, what a tremendous compliment to me. I don't identify. I think that I'm anything like Mother Teresa. But the experience certainly changed my life and changed my outlook and really changed the way that I see the world and changed my idea of giving. A lot of people said to me afterward, well, you're done now. You don't have to do anything for the rest of your life. And I was 37 when that happened, and I thought, oh, I have what, maybe another 70 years. I hope I continue to give.
So with the story you just told, could you tell me a little bit more about the connection that you found between being a feminist or being involved with women's studies and making the decision to donate the kidney?
Yes, of course. Well, one of the things that I think feminism teaches us is about privilege and power. And it seems a little corny to think that I felt privileged because I had two kidneys. But the more I read about kidney donation and the human body and really only needing one kidney, I thought, I have a spare for a reason. Got two, give one is the mantra for living donation. And really, feminism, women's studies, social justice is about only using as much as you have, about sharing with people that you don't know. And the few people on campus who I told about my kidney donation were folks in the women's studies program, and they all understood. They didn't question why I was doing it. I had other people on campus not respond so favorably. They weren't necessarily negative about it, but I could tell from their reactions that they thought that what I was doing was crazy or beyond crazy, I guess. But I did not get that reaction from my friends in the women's studies program. I think that they just understood that, of course. And the more reading I did about living donation, I thought, you know, I went into it thinking, well, how could I do this? And then the more I read, I thought, how could I not do this? And that kind of transformation, and again, the phrase I'll use is leap of faith, I think is not necessarily rooted in feminism, but is one of the ethics that feminists adhere to, is that, you know, you have to give over, you have to believe in the transformation. And I also had to intellectualize what I was doing, but I also really had to follow my intuition, which was to say that everything led to doing this, everything fell into place. I found out, for instance, that as a state of Wisconsin employee, I could take a 6-week leave of absence and still get paid as a living donor. And so it really all came together. And I don't know if I wasn't on a college campus and if I wasn't surrounded by really progressive people, would I have been in this kind of position to give up one of my organs? Probably not.